Support for this podcast comes from the UTSA Institute of Texan Cultures. For more than 50 years, the museum has told stories of Texas history and heritage from diverse cultures that define the state's unique character. Details at texancultures.com.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. The last decade was one heavily shaped by technology and how we use it. And as the tech landscape went through a major change, so did we. But no technology is in itself good or evil. It's how people use it or how people who are being used or manipulated by those who have mastered that technology. We're joined by Lee Rainey, the Director of Internet and Technology Research at the Pew Research Center. And Lee Rainey, welcome to The Source.
Hi, Dave. I'm glad to be with you.
It's good to have you. Our phone lines are open, and call in. Tell us, has your relationship with technology and online media changed in the last decade? What lessons did you learn? What lessons would you like society to learn about how we use technology? Call in with your questions and comments, 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tweet at us at tprsource. So Lee Rainey, I'd really be interested to hear how has your job changed over the last decade, because it seems like the scales have fallen from our eyes and we realize that technology and our relationship with it is more important than ever.
That has affected my job. I've been researching the rise of the internet and digital technologies for over 20 years, and the 2010s were the years when a reckoning began to occur for technology. There was such enthusiasm for the internet itself, for broadband, for the rise of smartphones, for the rise of social media. And then the chickens came home to roost in many respects. So the 2010s was a decade when you got the first tech lash against things like harassment online. It was a relatively new phenomenon and relatively toxic one for lots of Americans. It was the decade of big disclosures related to privacy and surveillance. So the Edward Snowden disclosures in mid-2013 and all the data breaches that have affected both companies and the government since then. And then, of course, the Cambridge Analytical problems, so that people are now much more aware than they were at the beginning of the decade about how they're being surveilled, how their information is being captured and used in ways that they don't necessarily like, don't necessarily know about. And it was the decade, of course, that we saw the rise of a term called fake news. And there's lots of concern now about the information flows that these technologies enable.
So, Lee, we ought to pay close attention and monitor our relationship with technology and how vulnerable it makes us as individuals, if we're, you know, getting ID stolen or something, or also as a society, as we're being fed certain information which may or may not be true, in order to try and manufacture consent.
Yeah, people are very much now tuned into the idea that they need to be more careful than they might have been thinking a decade ago. They are thinking about their screen time itself and their children's screen time, what it might be doing to their brains, to what it might be doing with their social interactions or the distractions that emerge in their life, and the content, of course, that comes into their lives. There are also people who are worried just about the amount of time they themselves spend on their screens and with social media and other kinds of platforms. And we've begun to see people who take sabbaticals from their technology, and people who walk away from situations that are too filled with drama or too filled with concerns that other people are raising that don't seem really relevant to them. So again, there's this widespread feeling that technology is more important in people's lives, even as it is raising more challenges for them to get a grip on it.
So you at the Pew Center have come up with 10 tech-related trends that shaped the decade. Are these in any particular order?
Well, we just started with sort of the bigger stories. The rise of smartphones and social media, of course, was the dominant story just from an adoption point of view. Both of those things were at relatively modest levels in the year 2010. And now social media is being used by 75% of the adults in the country, and 81% of the adults in the country, and even more teenagers, have smartphones. So people's very relationship with news and information and with each other has been radically recast by the rise of these technologies in their pocketbooks and their purses and ubiquitous part of their lives.
And when we say social media and these new platforms online, are there particular ones that are they like solid? These are the social media platforms that everyone uses, or is that changing?
It is changing. The dominant ones have been around for a while. About 75% of adults in the country now participate in YouTube or watch YouTube videos. About 7 in 10 participate in Facebook. And then it drops off to things like Instagram, which is used by 37% of the population, and Twitter. Only 22% of adults in the country use Twitter, but it's a really important platform for news and information, particularly in civic and media culture. But as you say, there's a change even as we speak. There are new platforms coming online. There's a very popular Chinese service called TikTok that allows people to send short videos to each other. It's taken parts of the world by storm, including parts of America by storm. So it's a very evolving story.
So I remember when there used to be like MySpace, and that was big, and then it died suddenly. So just because we have a platform that is big today doesn't mean it's going to be big tomorrow. And 10 years from now, we could be talking about a completely different menu of items.
One of the things that a lot of people say, especially when we talk to experts sort of looking ahead into the future, is a very strong sense that these technologies are going to fade into the background, that they are not necessarily going to be as visible to us as they currently are on our screens, that the internet itself might come through your earbuds or might come through interfaces that are available to you when you're sitting in a room. You'll be able to talk to it, maybe even think into it. And so in a way, these suite of technologies, the digital technologies, will become even more important and vital to people as they fade into the background and the wallpaper of their lives.
Many people, when we talk about social media and how information is being funneled through social media, a lot of people are getting their news from that. There has been some social activism that a lot of people thought was great, like Me Too and Black Lives Matter. But then there was also there was some negative information that we know it came from Russia, which infiltrated our elections. So it's not like this thing is good or bad in and of itself. It's how it's used, right?
I really like the way you framed the conversation at the very top of your remarks. This is a very mixed story. There's a dark side to it and a bright side to it, and Americans are struggling with that. So in some respects, they love the idea that social media gives voices to new people in public spaces and in public forums. It introduces new information to civic conversations and other kinds of conversations. It gives groups that hadn't necessarily been widely recognized in the past the chance to organize and have their views heard. But it also is a way, of course, to be deeply exploited as information gets weaponized, as rumors and just flat-out false information is allowed to travel around the world sort of unregulated on these platforms. And so Americans have a very sort of mixed sense about what this is doing to them. And again, sort of just like you said at the top of the show, people for themselves think, this is great. I can expose myself to new things that I never could before. I can meet new people. I can learn about any subject that I care about. It's great. But in the impact on society, I'm not
right.
So happy with
that's
that.
That's the big but. And we're going to talk more about that. And if there's going to be an era of social learning about how to deal with social media, we'll talk about that when we come back. The number to call in, if you've got a question, observation, how have you been dealing with social media? What are your plans for the new decade? 210-614-8980. 210-614-8980. The source continues after this.
Well,
Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio. In the next half hour, we're going to be talking about testosterone. It's more than just a molecule. It is a social construct. How has misinformation and misunderstanding about testosterone, how is it impacting our society, and how can we move forward from that? That's coming up in the next half hour. But right now, we're talking about tech trends in the 2010s, the past decade, and how has our society been shaped by the explosion of the internet and technology that we use every day without even thinking about it, but it has become a major change. So how did your use of technology evolve in the last decade? Do you feel like the emergence of social media changed your daily life? Can you remember life before smartphones or smart devices? What are the positive and negative effects of the changes to technology, the technology landscape in the 2010s? Call in. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. I'd love to hear what your observations are. With us right now is Lee Rainey, Director of Internet and Technology Research at the Pew Research Center. And so, Lee, did we really see an explosion of use of smartphones in this last decade?
Absolutely. Now 8 in 10 American adults have them. And there's been a big shift just in the way that people interact with the internet. It's now much more a mobile experience than it is a desktop experience for a lot of people. And that changes the kind of information they get. I mean, think about your own listeners who potentially are listening to this on an app rather than on a classic radio-ish kind of device in the past. And they'll be listening to it and maybe not necessarily the time we're talking. So there's a sense that it prolongs the way that media and conversations can exist into the future and can be searchable into the future. It's also made them much more likely to be immediately used for people to get information in real time, to drive around town, to get information about arguing a bar bet and things like that. So there's a sense that information has now become sort of an extra body part, just like an arm or a leg or a new lobe in your brain.
And any information that you might want is pretty much available at your fingertips if you've got a smartphone that's connected to the internet.
That's right, and people now expect that. So in a way, the notion that you can be an instantaneous consumer of any kind of information you want has swept its way through the culture in lots of different ways. It comes in the rise of the gig economy. When people want to buy something now, they can have a car driven by somebody else delivered it to their door, and maybe not in the too distant future, a drone deliver it to their door. So there's a sense that the pace of life has been picked up by this, and there's a sense that whatever I want and wherever I want it, it will be available to me as I need it.
So the growth in mobile and social media, this has sparked a debate about screen time. How much is too much for America's youth and even, you know, just everyone? Is it making us miserable?
Yeah, there's a famous cover story in the Atlantic Monthly a while ago, is Google make you stupid? And the argument basically was that there's so much information cascading into people's lives so often that, first of all, it's distracting and can take you away from the task at hand. And secondly, that the ubiquity of it itself is its own sort of reorientation of your brain and reorientation of your social connections and things like that.
Right. So I heard that some people, they can't even follow simple directions to get to one point to another point. They have no, they can't orient themselves to travel a city without a GPS device.
Well, yeah, and it's a walking compendium of all the data of their lives. They don't necessarily have to remember phone numbers anymore, and they don't have to necessarily remember stuff about the people they're going to meet because they get access just a couple of seconds before the meeting itself. If you go to a parent chat rooms and websites or Facebook pages, what you'll see is an almost constant drumbeat of conversation about the right amount of screen time for children. The one of the big concerns about screen time is what it's doing to young children's brains, what it's doing to their capacity to be socially engaged with others, what it's doing physically to their bodies. Are they hanging around their house and getting fat on their couches rather than running around the neighborhood kind of things? And so there's this very urgent set of conversations about screen time and the way that it affects young children.
Right, this hyper-connected isolation. The more connected you are, actually, the more alone you feel. Let me go to a caller with Manuel. Hey, Manuel. So He's talking about how social media is impacting family life. Has any observations for that, Lee Rainey?
Yeah, it's been so interesting to watch how the initial enthusiasm about social media that, again, it could expose people to brand new kinds of information and people and cultures and things like that, how it's now turned into this conversation about an impact on family life. One of the most striking things we did last year was to do surveys and interviews in emerging economies, so not in America, but in places like Mexico and India and the Philippines and Jordan and Lebanon. And the parents in those countries have the same conversations that the parents in America have about worries that their children are spending too much time on their screen, worries about the kind of people and information that their children can encounter on their screens, worries that their kids are being distracted and diverted from more useful parts of life by these devices. So this is a global conversation about these very powerful technologies.
But we're seeing a drop-off in the birth rate in the United States. We don't want to go the way of Japan, where their population is no longer able to sustain itself. Is anyone looking to see if there's some sort of crossover?
It's always a big research question when new technologies get introduced to cultures, what's going on. The story with birth rates is much more a demographic story and a story about the rising affluence of a lot of cultures, and people tend to have fewer babies when their economic circumstances get better. So this has been a story that has predated the rise of the internet in the world, but it's certainly now the rise of technology has been part of the sort of advancement of development and developing economies into to other parts of the world. And so it's part of the conversation, but it's probably not the dominant part of the story.
So in June 2013, we had then National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden be able to give us information that we didn't have before about how the National Security Agency, NSA, was able to surveil all of us using, and they were saving all this information about our online and phone communications. So, I mean, this was a decade where data privacy was unveiled.
Yes, there you could see this building even before the Snowden revelations, but after that, and then after the big wave of breaches of technology companies and other companies, people's credit card records, people's birth information, people's email addresses, all kinds of things. So people, Americans now, have a much more vivid sense of their vulnerability related to privacy. They're confused about what's going on. They don't necessarily know all the information that's being captured. They don't have a sense of how it's being used. They worry that it might come back to haunt them, but they don't even know how to fix a problem if it ever arises because they don't know how they're being profiled. And they also don't think that it's paying off for them. So one of the questions we've asked is whether the benefits outweigh the risks. I mean, you do get benefits when there is data being collected about you. You get free web services, you get security services provided by your government and your national government and things. But Americans now don't think the bargain is worth it. They think the risks outweigh the benefits, and it's partly from this sense of vulnerability that they now have.
And they say the data economy is bigger than the actual oil economy.
Yeah, there's a lot of smart analysis, particularly in the economic field, about the value of data and how it's being used. And again, this is sort of the Wild West in some respects in terms of regulation. Yesterday, a brand new law in California went into effect that tightened up on a variety of things, and it was in some respects modeled after a very ambitious and sweeping law in Europe. But there are lots of places in America where there isn't a very strong sense of privacy being something that governments and regulatory agencies care about. And it's probably going to be a huge conversation in the next decade as more and more of our devices get smarter. Appliances get smarter. The environment gets smarter. We might be driving in driverless cars. So this is a problem and a debate that's going to grow over time.
There's a backlash, a growing backlash. And you talk about that in this article that y'all have. That people are starting to ask questions and demand accountability. It's being talked about in our presidential election for the Democratic candidates, whether or not your private data should belong to you.
Yes. The other part of the, at least on the Democratic side, one of the major debates is about this, the actual size of the technology companies themselves. So it's not only what they're doing with data and collecting it and using it, but it's also whether they wield too much power over individual lives and also over the information and news flows in people's lives.
So the made-up news and misinformation, that's also sparked a concern and a backlash.
Yes, we did a series of studies in the past 2 years, really since the 2016 election, to try to pin down how Americans are thinking about this. First of all, they think it's a big problem in the culture. So more than half of Americans now say that misinformation is a major problem that needs to be dealt with, more than who say that there are major problems related to terrorism or to illegal immigration or to sexism or racism. So people think this is now sort of getting at the foundations of democracy, and they're quite worried about it. One of the most interesting ways in the past decade that we tackled this phenomenon was to do a survey, a nationally representative survey, where we gave people five statements of fact and five statements of opinion, and just asked them which is a statement of fact and which is a statement of opinion. And only fewer than a quarter of Americans could get all of the facts and opinions correctly identified as facts and opinions. But we also saw this phenomenon where people, if they agreed with an opinion, they called it a fact. If they disagreed with a fact, they called it an opinion. So there's a sense that how Americans process information and how they think about information is partly tied to how they evaluate information, and particularly in the partisan context. Is it good for my party and my team, or is it harm my party and my team? And that's a major lens through which a lot of information is now screened.
So are we getting better, though? I mean, give me some optimism here that people are learning to tease out fake news from real news. They're they understand that, check the source, understand that there are people out there who have an agenda trying to manipulate you, and you should be more cautious.
So here's the hopeful way to look at this. A lot more people now know this is going on and are aware that this is a general problem. They still think that it's toxic for the culture and that it's not been defeated yet, or even that the corner has been turned on this. But there's a sense that this is something to worry about. There's also a really interesting set of conversations in the educational community about information literacy and technology literacy, and how maybe that needs to be added to the standard literacies that are now taught in K through 12 schools and, of course, in college and things like that. So there are ways in which the culture is beginning to respond to these concerns, but most Americans don't think that we have turned the corner.
When you say the culture, I don't wonder if we even have a single culture anymore in America, because, you know, different demographics are going to be impacted by those stats in different ways. All of these stats in which we've talked about, including access to being online.
Yeah, that's such a great insight. And a lot of the work we do here at the Pew Research Center is unpacking this stuff. So young people and old people react to information and process information in different ways. Whites and blacks and Hispanics and Asians, the same. People who have higher levels of education are different from those who have lower levels of education and how they think about this stuff. So in many ways, this is a balkanized story. It's not a uniform story where different parts of the society are thinking about it in different ways and even thinking that the problem is different.
And the reliance on algorithms and thinking that algorithms are somehow going to be benign and see things in a fair way. They're just as good as the people who created them to begin with.
Well, and again, speaking about things that are going to become magnified in the next decade, that's a big one. The role of algorithms now is a bit more well understood by the general population than it used to be. And people are worried about bias and misinformation creeping into the systems. They're worried about the people who code the algorithms. So you're going to have a big moral debate about how algorithms can serve us and how they can harm us.
All right. Lee Rainey is the Director of Internet and Technology Research at the Pew Research Center, talking about tech trends from the 2010s. When we come back, we're going to talk about testosterone. Probably everything that you think you know about testosterone is wrong. That's coming up. Stay tuned. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.